first off, I owe you an apology for one of the readings. When I was rereading Evolution of Cooperation, that the Axelrod chapter I had assigned, I had forgotten how essential the basics of the Prisoner's Dilemma. Prisoner's Dilemma is one of the most robustly tested results in experimental sociology, and I had forgotten to provide enough background material before signing the reading, so I apologize for that. So I will break that out, and I will go over the background material. The reason that I assigned this chapter from that book, as opposed to the basics of the tit for tat strategy, the tit for tat strategy is about cooperation and defection between individuals. What Axelrod then built on top of that, obviously, is the spread of cooperation into groups, which is what we're interested in here, but I did not provide enough of the backstory. So I apologize, I'm trying to rectify that, but it will be, obviously, in the reverse order of what I should have done. So there it is. What I want to do today, obviously go over the readings, but also do another exercise designed to test and examine some of the assumptions. We've got a lot of background material now on groups I've put on the board, and we'll go over this, some things we know about groups now, some basic designing groups, if you want to talk about designing groups, or basic interpretive issues if you want to talk about understanding existing groups. But before we do that, I want to ask, from your point of view, and this is an open-ended question because it's a complicated one to a certain degree, what is a group? We have to come up with some definition of group that which we've never defined in this class, although we've approached it up until now in a kind of know-what-we-mean way. We haven't really put an edge on it or any set of sort of litmus test definitions.
I don't know if this is a kind of a circular argument, but when I think of group, I think of a collective. I mean, I don't know if that's rephrasing, you know what I mean, but...
Well, so tell me how collective differs from group, and we'll know whether or not it's a rephrase.
Well, I mean, so for example, just drawing from some of the readings, like a group could be formalized.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in other words, getting together with a specific goal in mind.
Yeah, come sit at the table.
Watch that power.
You
were just like, I thought she had a chair.
Go on.
Right, so formalized in the way that they come together to kind of pursue a goal, or kind of ad hoc, or I think concocted is.
Yeah, you're drawing the two-axis chart, which we'll look at from the small groups reading, which we'll look at in a bit. But I'm not fishing for an answer from the readings. I really do mean it as an open question. Because one of the interesting things, and you'll see this over the whole semester, almost everyone who takes on the problem has to offer some definition of the group early in the writing, because there's no obvious stable, formal answer. There are bunches of words like that, unfortunately, in this area. If you look up community, for example, there's a dozen definitions in the dictionary that have to do with people who see one another interact all the time, to the community of French speakers, which is so diffuse as to be almost unobservable. Group is a word like that. So there's something, we've been using the word in here in a kind of know-what-we-mean way, and fairly satisfactory, but we haven't yet pulled it down.
I was thinking more than one.
More than three or more?
Say it, more than two. Why is it not just more than one? Why does it have to be more than two?
Three
is proud, right. Three is, I mean, that's one of the things we know about groups. Three is a magic number. Three is where a bunch of the group effects that we care about kick in: audience effects, persistence, keeping track of external connections that you're not participating in. So we can say at least the groups have a lower bound of three.
They can be defined by a mutual goal or a mutual destiny.
Mutual goal or mutual destiny. Okay. Jackie, you're starting.
Oh, yeah, I mean, that's That's it. I was just trying to think, like, what are group properties that every single group has? That's
well, you know, I mean, if you want to do every single group, it's going to be a set, right? I mean, there's really something about human social groups as we've been talking about them here. So I'm more interested not in having a definition that covers everything, but actually narrowing the definition down to the kinds of groups we've been talking about up until now. If you want to give someone a test or a list of features, we've got two already, more than three people, and they can be held together by either mutual goals or mutual destiny.
Well, I would add to that communication.
Tell me, go on.
Just a way to communicate. In whether they meet or whether they, I don't know, there's a chat room or there's a workspace, there's a place or a means for them to communicate together. And that's the
same. What is that?
You don't have a little international students. It'll be 3 years they don't communicate. The only thing that it's like common that it's like makes them a group is that they're international students.
Well, you can
it's
have
like
a group of
three people walking down the street, and the only thing that makes them in common is that they're walking next to each other, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, I don't see how they have a common
I think Andy's suggesting no, that they would not be part of a group.
I think they are. I think that for a broad definition, what you need is just a point of cohesion, like something that ties them together for that period of time. That makes a very weak group, but they have one sort of point of cohesion that they're walking roughly in sync.
It's more obvious when you see a group of people walking down the street, and like that group of people are there, and then you see them interacting with each other.
They don't necessarily have to interact.
Is this like an identifiable set, I guess, kind of in a way? Like international students, they don't have to talk or communicate or do anything together, but they're a group.
They have a common identity.
But they wouldn't.
I don't even think it needs to be a common identity. You can.
But do they see each other?
Couldn't you say, oh, there's a group of people going into a state?
Say that again, bro.
Do they see each other as a member of that group? I think that's if they have one.
So they're knowledgeable.
I'm part of an international student group, but I don't think that
but if you look at them on a photograph, you can be like, what's that group? Or you see them across the street, you know?
Let's just say they are like they're suddenly cut off by a car. You know what I mean? It's like they're a group of walkers that suddenly are walking.
What about like non-racial groups where you don't necessarily have to?
The men are driving
to
the
women's
situations, yeah.
Oh, I say the gaze could be an internal one where there is a feeling of a group, but I agree with Abe that an external gaze would also generate a group.
Okay.
So just an agreement, maybe, like an agreement either with the people that are inside of the group or with people who are looking at others.
Right. Actually, then you should go ahead and introduce yourself.
I'm Tikla. Hi. I'm now in the class.
Since you're new to the group.
I was just saying that if there was if you're part of a racial or ethnic or some other type of group that you don't necessarily put yourself in, but other people will put you in it, or you don't necessarily identify, but you're kind of in that group.
This is the external gaze.
Yeah, I guess so. The external gaze. Or even you could identify with it, but I don't know.
And you're affected. You can be affected by being part of a group even if you don't know yourself.
And the suggestion was raised that the group of people on the street is a weak group, which suggests that there's another category that we would call a strong group.
Yeah.
What are some things that would move you on the spectrum from weak to strong?
Identification with the group. You know, a common cause or. Like, for example, if you are all foreign exchange students, but all from different countries versus all from the same country or even from the same time.
Right. You know,
right. Recognition of what your goal is. Or the identity or whatever.
The need to make decisions.
I'm sorry?
The need to make decisions at one point.
Very good. Now. I want to point out that both identification and recognition, which are the two previous characteristics, have this characteristic of internal or external gaze.
I can identify myself, I can self-identify as a member of the forces, or I can be regarded as ethnic. Both of those may push me into a stronger group. They also have the effect of potentially creating a situation where if everybody treats me that way, then that's the way I'm going, then I'm going to start taking on that identification and vice versa. So, and this is something that came up, I think, pretty strongly in the Paradox of Groups reading, that the amount that groups know about themselves by reflection from the external environment, it means that whether or not you're talking about internal sense of membership or external sense of membership becomes an important addition characteristic.
What about kind of false indoctrination? In other words, being regarded as part of a group by the group, but not actually wanting to be part of it. For example, when I get junk mail from the National, you know, the Republican Party, mm-hmm. right? Well, I don't know how or why they have my address. And apparently, they consider me to be one of them, but I don't want to be. You know, I don't want.
But
to
now,
be
does that strengthen your ties to that group?
If anything, it repulses them.
Right. So then that's not something that is driving you to increase membership in the group. So what are they doing wrong? They want you to be part of the group, and you're not doing it. What's going on there?
I guess they've categorized me correctly, mm-hmm. you know, because I would say, you know, in other circumstances, well, if they had asked instead of being, you know, assumptive, then I might say, well, okay, maybe, but not in this particular case. But as far as they're concerned, from their perspective, maybe I am part of the group, or at least they see me that way.
Well, so is, this gets back to the weak, strong economy, is the Republican Party a weak or a strong group? And I don't mean in terms of political strength. I mean in the terms we're talking about here, in terms of things like high degree of communication, high degree of membership, high degree of mutual identification, strong in what way?
Because they, like, most of those are there, have a strong sense of identification. Like they have, like, they think about politics in a certain way, they think about social welfare in a certain way, they think about, like, all these different political issues that brings them together to say, like, yeah, we're Republican.
I would say they have a strong center, but a weak periphery, a weak but broad periphery.
Okay, go on.
Like, I mean, like the core, like, when you're, if you're a Republican senator, well, like, yeah, like, you're, that's a tight identification, and you're
like
eating lunch with,
values.
You know, the Republican lobbyists, like, you're in a very tightly knit group, and you understand, and, like, when Karl Rove calls you, like, you know what you're supposed to do, and... But then there's all these people, like, you know, some people are dedicated, you know, they give a few $100 a year, and they're pretty dedicated Republicans. And there's people who, like, vote Republican, but, you know, every once in a while they vote for a Democrat, or, like, they flip-flop. Or, like, so it's like, yeah, it's not, as you move out from the center, you have this, the ties get weaker and weaker, but it's very broad.
Because
it's
then that should be another group.
Well, not because it's, I mean, there's a platform.
Yeah, but I mean, that would be like a
single
group.
That kind of makes me wonder if quality or quantity has anything to do with the strength of a group. Because the Republican Party is a big group. There's a lot of people associated with it. However, can we call it stronger when we've kind of come to that ideal number of three being the, you know, the ideal connection? Because you could.
That's not the ideal. That's just a lower bound. I don't mean to propose that three is any kind of ideal. It's just three is the first point at which the effects we care about in this class started here. But I think you're on to something with the question of scale. I just don't think it's tied to the threeness of the thing.
Well, I mean, it's like you pointed out in the last class, you have three people, you have three routes of communication, I guess, that, you know, everyone's got on equal ground. Whenever you start introducing 5, 10, 20, the more people you put in, the more complex it is, you know. And so maybe he is a Republican at heart. We don't know. And he's, just, he's got a weak connection to the center.
Well, then you start getting subgroups in terms of that. And then within the subgroups, we have maybe stronger connections, or, you know, I'm a radical Republican, or I'm a, you know, like the Greens within the group. And you're still going to have ties, but maybe you don't, you know.
Maybe the different levels of identification or activity in the group and create this periphery and it's quite natural that the big groups will tend to create this hierarchy inside the group. But I'm jumping a couple of classes forward, but when we're speaking about the internet, we get really large groups that are quite equal in hierarchy, and that's where it's starting to be more different than the groups we're going to know.
Well, let me ask a related question. Are the Democrats a strong group?
Politically, I don't. I mean, in the context of what we're talking about, sure, but I mean, politically as a group, I think they're much weaker.
Well, we're comparing them to the Republicans,
right?
But then, what about versus the Green Party?
Well,
we're, you know, it's like,
what a problem. Weaker in the content that if you're relating to another group, like it's a very strong role as a political
identity. Depends on the group.
Well, I think part of the problem is like they're so big that they essentially in this country you basically have two parties, and there's like other three, just other, you know, Green Party or Libertarian, whatever. But essentially, you're either identified as either Democrat or Republican, which makes them so big that you have to fall in one or the other, which means that you're most likely, like, the majority of people are going to be further away from like, where the sort of core center is in a way. So it's like the groups are, you know, the sense is only like two, it doesn't really allow for much like, a sense of identity within it necessarily.
It depends on what we're defining as success or like strength of the group, though, too, because if you're talking about this, if the group is identity and the people that are identified by it, and you look at the numbers, if you want to look at like red and blue states or whatever, however you want to look at these last elections, the number of people that identify with a certain side is kind of the same. So we're talking about like an identification or an execution. And I think the big thing within both of them is that they've taken on like a broad enough set of terms that people can reinterpret for themselves, to like find parts of it to invest in or not invest in. That's maybe where the strength in size lies, but what execution, etc.
We're thinking about strength as if it's a general property of the group, but what we're answering is, does the group how strong is the group in achieving its goals? And in the case of political parties, as big they are, as much more voters that they can, it helps them reach the goal. But if we were comparing the Republican Party to a group that's supposed to come up with a program or something like the example we had in the text, it would be much weaker. So I think we should compare groups based on their goals, their ability to achieve their goal.
Well, so let me suggest something to see if this fits. That the Dean campaign, people campaigning for Dean, were a stronger group than the people campaigning for Kerry. But the Kerry campaign was more effective than the Dean campaign. I think that there may be something about group cohesion. I mean, Abe was saying this in terms of center and edge. Group cohesion that isn't completely tied to effective. That you can analyze a political organization based on its effectiveness, but that there are, in a way, the effectiveness is an outcome of all kinds of other things. But the thing that was apparent about the Dean campaign during its operation, before anyone knew what would happen, is that as a group it was considerably stronger. And it's in a way, it's that strength, I think, that we're... Certainly, the readings are concerned not so much with the outcome of group efforts. These readings are not drawn from the business books that say how to lead an effective team. Whatever. I have not included any of those readings here because they tend to be exhortational and not terribly accepting of the idea that sometimes groups just fail. But there are strong failed groups and there are weak successful groups. And I think that any idea of strength and weakness in groups has to account for that. That we can't use an external metric. The suggestions I've heard so far are that whatever the threshold for a weak group is, the groups get stronger with some sense of identity, some sense of recognition, some sense of communication. What else, if we wanted to flesh that list out a little more, what else makes groups...
I think sometimes like the strength of group is determined by the person who represents the group. I think sometimes formation of the group may be strong and the unification is strong, but whoever represents the group determines whether that group is weak, can be weak or strong.
Whoever represents the group.
Yeah, like the leader.
Give me an example.
Like the leader. Well, I mean, I don't want to get this discussion into too political, but in my personal opinion, during the presidential campaign between Bush and Kerry, although I think the Democratic Party was strong, but I think Kerry represented the party weaker than Bush, meaning that he gained people's belief. He projected a certain image to, I think, some certain people that he wasn't strong enough to Bush. And I think that image sort of portrays a lot about his party.
Can you give me a smaller group? I mean, part of the problem with going all the way to the National Democratic Republican Party is they are very large, and there are essentially two buckets. Right? That there are a handful of other parties, but they are in a fractional minority here. And the kinds of group effects, when we talk about strong groups, we're talking about groups where they're actually communicating with one another and have kind of some sense of shared membership or whatever. That tends towards smaller groups. So bring it down, mayoral campaign or some other non-political non-political group. What effect does the leader have? And what aspects of ITP are derived from Red? You can compare Red and Nicholas Negroponte and the whole field day later on. No. I mean, it's remarkable how much both institutions have been, you know, two decades of change of benevolent dictatorship, and they've both been largely shaped by those leaders. And there's obviously significant differences between them, a lot of which emanates from the personality of the founders. I mean, we don't need to do that comparison now. I'm just saying the point.
The only thing that I can come up with, trying to think of something that's, I guess, a little more like, it's a legitimate, but it's like baseball, right? Well, and the Red Sox finally won the World Series, right? And for all those years, they had a lousy staff and a lousy leader, right? And then all of a sudden they won, and it was right about the time, I mean, I'm not a baseball fanatic, I don't really know the exact dates or the numbers or whatever, but it was right about the time that they changed management. And then they hired a new head coach or whatever, I don't even know what it's called in baseball, but for all of those years they were viewed as a losing team and they never won, and it was all like, you know, they're cursed or whatever.
Now they're selling more jerseys than the Yankees.
Yeah. So, creating an image,
right,
in from the top and then letting it come down into the players. Right. An image of themselves,
Actually, when, I don't know your name, sorry, but when you were talking,
Abe.
Actually, when I, what is
Abe.
Abe. No, not Abe.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I see. When you were talking, what I heard also was attraction, just being attracted to the person you see, being attracted to people who are in that group or wanting to be.
Right. No, a lot. I mean, this is the paradox of groups. One point in paradox of groups is that groups see how they are doing in the world often by seeing how people in other groups are reacting to them, seeing what they're up there.
So a lot of groups fall apart because of the leader leaving the group for some reason. And you can see in a meeting, there's a meeting, I saw this Monday at the Werner meeting with 20 people, and one of the persons was saying something in the meeting, and then the leader of the group and the chair of the meeting left the room for some reason. And as he left, people just kind of started talking to each other.
Yes.
Like the group, like this whole group that was like listening to this person, just kind of just started
talking. Why was that?
Why?
Why was that?
because everything was address. Like, the thing about it is, like, it's funny how, like, the leader leaves and then the group disappears. So it's because the leader is the one that is listening and the person is addressing the leader. But the others overhear what is said.
It depends on what the group, what structure that the group creates. If the group creates a structure that is built on the leader, but when the leader is gone, the structure is gone and the group is gone.
Yeah.
But if the group doesn't require a leader.
No, that's what I'm saying. It's just like it's a different type of
order. Exactly. It's not only a matter of leader. There are different structures and groups, but the structure is a very crucial element of the group formation.
A leader is like a point of cohesion. It's like, and there's other possible points of cohesion within the group, but the leader is a strong one generally, right? And especially the stronger the leader is, the more they can actually probably destroy other points of cohesion. The group becomes focused upon the leader, whereas the leader actually nurtures other points of cohesion. They can leave the room and
leave the room and work goes on, right?
Yeah.
It's like, especially the matter of you put the sort of purpose of the group into the leader. Then when they leave, then that's the purpose of the group. Whereas the purpose is dissipated and pops the group.
So you have a story quoted from Freud in Paradox of Groups about this. And that there's a mention in Paradox of Groups about exactly that scenario. Do you remember the reference? It's just say it. Assyrian.
Soldiers that died.
Yes.
Yes. Was there the piece had was cut off and they felt they projected themselves into him.
They'd given such battlefield intelligence to the leader, and when they learned that his head had been cut off, they became confused. And the interpretation was that they had actually projected their intelligence onto the leader when he went missing. One of the things that hard to do sociological experiments on groups for obvious ethical reasons. So one of the things you look for is natural experiments. And one of the things, in terms of stronger and weaker, I think you can see a lot of the effects in your own time here. We're talking about groups at ITB not so much because they're particularly terribly important in the world, but because it's a shared point of reference. But for those of you, and maybe just about everybody, who've done a class in which there's group work within the class, what's the difference between being in the class as a student and being in that group? What's the difference between the relationship between the other members of your group and your relationship with the class as a whole? What happens in those small groups? I'm positing, first of all, that those small groups are stronger in the sense we're using that word. What happens in those groups that makes the difference?
Can you be a little more specific? Because I think I can think of a lot. Be a little more specific as to.
So you're in class. The idea is everyone's going to do a project, like Sergio's class, or one of the production classes. Everyone is going to do a project and present it in the gym, or everyone is going to do a project for the whole semester. But you're going to do it in groups. So in this class, you can imagine breaking up into four groups of four,
right,
being set loose on projects,
right,
and then reporting back on the December of the final. What you typically have a different relationship with the other members of your small group than with the class as a whole. What accounts for that difference?
It needs to have a consensus and a unique voice in the small groups.
Why?
That's what we're asked for. We're asked to create groups that become a cohesive single output, whereas as a group, it doesn't matter.
The output is the forcing function. I think you probably experienced it as the faculty member asking you to come to consensus, but really all they're asking for is output. And it's the output, it's the shared effort and shared output both have a lot to do with moving groups on that axis from weak to strong. So in addition to the characteristics you listed earlier, communications and so forth, we'll be interested, we are interested in hearing the readings reflect groups that have both shared effort and shared outcomes. And you can imagine, right, those are actually orthogonal characteristics. There's a lot of shared effort in the class. Everybody shows up at exactly the same time. We all sit here with the same, everybody hears the same thing, and yet the outcome of the class is different for each student. On the other hand, the market, right, everybody comes together but pursues different strategies, and in some ways the shared outcome, the price of the stocks that are being sold that day, is much higher than the amount of coordination the trainers have with one. So you can get things like marathons where everybody's running the same route but has a different outcome. You can get things like markets where everybody's pursuing different strategies, but the prices converge. So shared outcome, shared effort plus shared outcome is also something to look at in addition to some of the characteristics. So I'm going to move on to discussing particularly the paradox of group reading, the thing with the Assyrian reference campfire. But before we do that, I want to kind of as a backstory note, and specifically pull out some things we know about groups already. And this is a handful of things that we can take as I said, either observational or design numbers. Groups have first order properties. When you're looking at a group, there are behaviors that the group will exhibit that aren't completely derivable from the individuals. Autonomy and cooperation are fundamentally intention in human groups. You want to have complete autonomy to do as you like. You could, for example, get out in the middle of the class and walk out the door if you felt like going to get a bite to eat. Probably often feel like getting a bite to eat in the middle of the class, and you don't do it because the cooperation required for participation overrides autonomy. And those things are fundamentally intention for group statements. Group actions are path dependent, as we saw with the Katrina. Half for a national thing. A group having chosen B will prefer it over A later, even if you consensus that same group, had they chosen A, would prefer it over B later. They're also homeostatic, which is once a group forms, and it takes very little for a group to form. In an abstract exercise, in a class about groups, people are like, we got to win. We got to get our idea to win. It takes very little to trigger the kind of desire to maintain the internal state against the external world. And every time two of those groups combined and you felt a new sense of us and them, right, that was homeostasis kicking in, even in a very small way. As we said, three is a magic number. And we touched on the idea of scale, the Democratic Party, and so forth. Groups get complex faster than they get big. This is really an essential driver here. The number of potential two-way connections goes up with the square of the number of units, of the number of individuals. If you want to see the scaling stuff in action, watch if you're ever at a dinner party that goes from 6 to 7. Right? It will break down from one conversation to a conversation of 3 and 4 or a conversation of 3, 2, and 2. Right? That's the moment at which holding the whole group together in a scale in an intimate setting becomes too large and starts to subset. It's also about, although there's some physical components there, it's also about the size at which when people start clinking glasses, they will not make an effort to clink everyone else's glass. Because the n squared problem ultimately defeats that strategy. Below a certain size, it's rude not to. Above a certain size, it's rude to try. That's the scaling effect.
Is there a moment where complexity kind of reaches a maximum and then the scale can keep growing, but complexity?
That is an excellent question. My argument is I'm arguing yes, not so much that there's a moment, but rather that there are scales above which the only effective mode of communication is broadcast. Right? Because single point outbound, no return channel, no coordinating of participants is the only communication pattern supportable at a scale of, say, 10,000 and above. And there are ways of managing hierarchies larger than that, but that's effectively nested broadcasting, right? Down, down, down. The commander says this, the colonel says this, and the commander from the field says that, and goes down. It is not then that each private replies directly to the colonel up the chain. So yes, and we'll diagram that in considerably more detail, but I'll put down a marker saying that's exactly the right question. And one of the reasons we're interested in small groups is that the kinds of social complexities that come up are sub that scale very often. Emotion and opposition are both easily triggered. Paradox of groups actually offers at least one explanation for why the emotional triggering happens. There are several explanations, all of which can be partially true, but I think for now we don't have to say why, but rather just note that group life is emotional life in the way that individual life is not. And if you look at, for instance, if you just kind of think about your own emotional state when you're sitting in front of the screen, you will, I believe, almost invariably, possibly invariably find that it's when you were dealing with social software that your emotional reactions are the highest. And when you're dealing with personal software, Photoshop, Microsoft Word, you may have some kind of emotive reaction, but not nearly as strongly triggered as that
that comes from participating in a group. Process is violence. That the ideal state for a group because of the emotion is not to have to force a decision, but to allow things to kind of float around. There's a great example from the city council having to vote in Paradox of Groups, where the decision was made to simply postpone the decision because it was too electric to have to decide. There was that moment when the two groups of 12 came together here, and everybody's like, okay, we don't want to touch this. You tell us what to do. We know we have to decide, but you take over. And it was sort of like trying to hand the baton off to me, because the first person to open their mouth to take on a piece of process was the person advocating doing a little bit of violence in the sense of, can we really get away without having to make a decision? Decision-making in groups requires intelligence, finality, and support. What did I say? Yeah. In that order, which is to say, you want the group to come to the right decision, you want the group to come to a binding decision, and you want the group to support the decision. Unfortunately, there is no way of making a decision that maximizes all three things at the same time. Consensus, for example, maximizes support, but it postpones finality, potentially does some damage to intelligence, potentially particularly at large scale. Pure voting is great for finality, it's pretty good for support, particularly if there's already a social norm around voting. But it can minimize some of the intelligence by not allowing deliberative process and so forth. So the decision-making tools a group uses are trade-offs between those three things. And finally, social facts don't manage complexity, right? The hidden rules that everybody adopted, like you don't reintroduce failed suggestions at the next round, or once somebody suggests we go to a vote, everybody says, yeah, okay, let's vote. Those are things that I did not introduce into the exercise, but by custom made a certain amount of sense and helped everybody get through it. So that as background, some things we know. Want to dig now into the readings, which are both, and when I say both, I'm separating the Axelrod reading, the cooperation reading. Both Paradox of Groups and Small Groups as Complex Systems, the readings are suggested around the moment of founding. The starting of a group and for a particularly complicated period of that. So, paradoxes of groups first. The basic paradox of groups is that you can't have a group without members, which seems pretty obvious. But you also can't have members without a group, because what would they be members of? So there comes a moment where a group has to agree that they're a group so that the members can agree that they're members, right? And you can look at it from either the whole, when did the group coalesce, or you can look at it as a series of decisions by the individuals. Yes, we are now starting this company, this rock band, this whatever. But neither description is entirely accurate, right? And then from there, the authors go on to outline a number of other paradoxes. So let me bring up one, because I thought it was a really interesting illustration from that reading. Scapegoating. What, in their view, is the interpretation of scapegoating? Why does scapegoating make sense in group life?
It's a strategy.
In what way?
To make them work towards one goal by blaming someone, the other.
So what's the process by which scapegoating happens?
Like all the bad things that happen to the group are because of that person.
That's the effect, but I'm
everybody has not guilt, but a responsibility in something. And whenever that fails, then rather than carry that responsibility on everyone in the group, they can assign it to one person, and then everyone else can be more efficient that way. Same thing with leadership, almost.
Yeah, it's splitting, where they and after, you know, whatever happens, you're not part of the group, or they have someone outside the group, and it's kind of like projection occurs, right? And that's what he talks about.
There was a situation. It wasn't exactly scapegoating. It didn't take place over a long period, but the period of highest anxiety at ITT is, of course, thesis week. And there was one presentation which was so
catastrophically disastrous.
I know what.
That you could feel the rest of the second year class go, oh, it wasn't mine. Right? Everyone was afraid that their presentation was going to be the disastrous one, that they uniquely were going to get up and fall on their face in front of the class. And then it happened. And you could almost feel the rest of the institution breathing a sigh of relief. And in fact, of course, that's completely ridiculous on an intellectual level. By that time, your thesis is in the can. It is what it is. You're going to do what you're going to do. It has the quality or lacks the quality that it has. Nothing has changed. And yet, this second kernel of concern, which is nagging at people, you could feel it getting externalized in that moment. So a lot of these effects you can watch happen both long and short term.
I mean, it's also utterly predictable which thesis it was going to be.
Yes, that's right. And that's kind of remarkable too, that there was a sense that this might be that this might be a train wreck in the making was not. I was watching from the outside, so I have a different sense of it. But the interesting thing to me was that even given some of the predictability, there was still a kind of collective sigh of relief, which was the occasion of this split, right? Or, yeah.
But as a member of the group, of the ICP group, it was demoralizing for me to see this.
Is that right? How come?
Because I felt like the bar, the standard had been dropped so much that,
go on.
That this group that I belong to didn't have the credibility that I had.
I really
was affected by it.
And I
went to the documentation to figure out what the logic behind this project was,
and
I still didn't make me feel better.
Right. That.
Go on. Well, also, I mean, the nature of the organization of the group, and you know the way that we're all put together, doesn't necessitate success of each individual because one person failed. The next person who goes up is just as likely to fail. You see what I mean? So breathing a collective sigh of relief because someone failed does not guarantee that if I go next, I'm gonna look any better because I could screw up even worse.
There's that old joke, although it hasn't been told, I think, in 4 years, but I'll tell it now. Whenever I get on an airplane, I carry a bomb with me because what are the chances that there's two bombs on the ground? The events are actually orthogonal. But the emotional reaction, and it's interesting because it may be among the first, it may have been more demoralizing among the first years at the time, because it said more about the institution and less about the particular moment that they were feeling.
I had a different take on it, I guess. To me, it seemed more positive. It's like, even if it was a failure, it's like somebody's taking risks. Somebody's kind of going, like, just taking more of a chance. And they, you know, if they do fail, it's still like, this is a place to take risks.
Mm-hmm.
And we're in a college setting, you know, and yeah, you know, it may not go so well, but at least it's inspiring that, like, you can do whatever you want, and, like, you know, and plus we're all talking about it as opposed to all the other ones which were successes, and, you know, maybe that...
I think there's also a sigh of relief that, it, like, that was all he did. There was no explosions, there were no dead bodies, there was a...
I don't want...
Perhaps at one point...
So in the context of this class, why wouldn't that create the effect you're imagining? If we were to show Jackie and Tifa the presentation, why would that not have the same effect that we're talking about?
For a lot of reasons, but number one, because we if not know him, we at least know the personality. Or the legacy, or the, you know, whatever.
Right. There's a social embedding that the playback of the content, if you're not embedded socially, is of almost no value, and that's obviously part of this. But to your point, do you remember that there was a phrase in there, and it just appeared once, it may not have jumped out at you. There was a phrase in there about what groups need to do in order to survive long-term around this tension between autonomy and cooperation. Did that jump out at anybody?
memory? Was there a memory? I don't remember that, but...
I'm fishing and it's one phrase, so if it didn't jump out of anybody, I'll pull it out.
Taking risks.
But in particular, the groups need to create room for conflict and ambivalence. Successful groups create room for conflict and ambivalence. Because if you don't, what happens?
Isn't this leading up to, like, I seem to recall something about this being kind of, in a psychological point of view, like, something about your mom.
Right.
Something about, like, you know, you have these systems developed.
I mean, yes, but once you get into psychology, it's
always good back to your mom.
The your mom thing is splitting. It's the idea of splitting that Jackie brought up earlier, which is that you take a piece of yourself and you project it onto the environment, or you take a judgment from the environment and you project it onto yourself, you internalize it on yourself. And both of those processes are obviously operating hand and tongue with infants who are separated in particular from their mothers. We don't need to, you know, I think that part we can take for granted. I'm more interested in what would happen to a work group if there was no space for conflict or ambivalence?
As soon as there's a diversion, then
I don't know if room is necessarily the right word, because you think of something like the Scientologists, they don't really need room for it. They have a channel in order to get rid of it. It's a different approach, but you know, they have a massive process of getting people clear. You know, like basically like channeling all the conflict out and like synchronizing. I mean, you see it in cults all the time, like where they like, you know, they don't leave room for conflict. They just find a way to get rid of it.
That's right. So it's, yeah, I mean, we should maybe specify healthy groups. In fact, a lot of what cults offer is a respite from ambivalence. Right? If you're tired of being ambivalent, cults are a great way to...
Yeah, that's what I think they succeed by having a sort of channel. Like, if conflict comes out, they have a way to get, like, expurge it from the group. Whereas...
But it's still, in a sense, room for it. It is managed.
Yeah.
Oh,
certainly. Like they certainly have a way to address it.
They haven't assumed that there won't be conflict and ambivalence. They've built a process for handling it, and there's maybe particularly unfair to the individual, but is certainly effective, obviously. So, somebody tell me the story of the vote at the city council. Do you remember that? Between, are we going to use this money to feed 10 people now, or are we going to use it to support? Because we recapitulated that to a degree in the exercise of the first class. Somebody tell me that story. What happened?
People divided both.
Yeah, they're divided.
So,
actually, when you asked about the incident with the Republic, this example immediately popped up, because by influencing you, or by influencing the women there that were, the women having a very strict idea about the person that didn't know what to choose. I saw that a very similar incident where one doesn't know what to choose or still can be affected by or change their opinion, but a group is so rejecting you from different reasons, and just by that, choose the other way, or kind of parts.
And the women didn't start out, the women on that panel didn't start out with a strict opinion about what they were going to do. How did it get strict?
Well, it turned into a stalemate. Uh-huh. And then the guy who was put in, I guess he was like the head guy who was put in charge of breaking the tie, offended one of them or said something that they misinterpreted, and they kind of came back together and said, well, if that's what you think, then this is what we're doing. And then going back to the original point of not having flexibility, you know, room for movement within that.
That subgroup was suddenly identified, it didn't exist before that moment.
Right. This is exactly the external gate, the internal identification thing, right? That they were just members of, it was a 7-person group, so we don't have big scale issues here. But suddenly when the 3 people who said, we want to feed the 10 people now, all had an externally observable characteristic, they're all female, that regard caused them to solidify. What happened to the vote? What happened to the decision?
It was stalemate. It had to go, and the guy left.
Right. Right.
You put me in a lose-lose situation.
And then what the
personal bubble. So basically, we need to find a new system of doing this, and until we vote and decide on that, we have to.
But nobody suggested flipping a coin.
They had to come up to the policies and how to deal with situations like that before they could actually make a decision at that point.
Did they have to do that? What do you think about that policy move? I mean, what did that seem like?
Well, the head of the council was male, or he just
he was male.
He wanted to stay out of, you know, I mean, right. Obviously he didn't want to be on the spot, so.
Right.
Going back to your very first question, it seems like here there's strength, there's no very strong group, there's no weakness.
But that the policy solution, the idea that, well, we've come to see that we need a policy for dealing with this, and therefore we're not going to decide now. What did that seem like? That jumped out at me as a real.
Well, that's just past the buck.
Yeah, it's a scapegoat. Yeah.
Right, right. There's the splitting for you. And in groups, and this is actually something that happens all the time, process is an embedded reaction of prior stupidity, right? Knives have handles because for a while they didn't. And after a while, people figured out this is what we ought to do instead. When you look at group process, you will see layers and layers of you have to fill out this form because 10 years ago somebody did something really stupid. And regret is a really powerful emotion. Regret is more powerful than happiness, right? If you lose $100, you're sadder than if you, you know, find $100 on the street. And often what happens in groups when they're put into emotionally unpleasant situations is they split off and project onto process their own interpersonal difficulties. Right? They actually had, and this is the remarkable thing, they had not only a perfectly effective process for voting, right? They had a backup process if voting failed, which is the chair serves as the tiebreaker. And they punted both of those bits of process. They didn't actually need more process. They could have solved the problem two different ways with the process that was locally available to them. And they labeled the need, they put around their emotional discomfort the need for more process. It seems to me as an excuse for being able to simply delay the decision until people's tempers cool. It is too bad that the rest of the story wasn't told. I wish the authors had followed up to figure out was there then behind the scenes politics to get somebody to change the vote or some compromise raised and stuff. That was a really, you know, that was an intersection of processes, violence, decisions required finality. Right? I mean, these things are in some tension. This list of things, you know, and that seemed to be the big illustration.
If there hadn't been that split, that subgroup formation, probably the chair would have actually decided.
Right. If it had been two women and one man against one woman and two men, it is much less likely either that they would have needed a tiebreaker or that they would have. Had they needed one, they would have refused to do one. I think that's exactly right.
Also, though, I mean, a large portion of the conflict was based on interpretation of a remark that somebody made that didn't necessarily mean one thing or the next.
So what about that?
Well, that's the psychology of the group of women.
Mm-hmm. You see what I mean? Say the same thing.
I would go on three.
According to the story, though.
Yeah, it seems like eventually the formation of these two groups made not one of the first questions that they were asked to choose from, but to just note that this remark made the two groups stronger in their own opinion.
Right. It goes back to one of the reasons it's talking about, like, you can list all the characteristics of the people in the group, but those aren't necessarily the characteristics of the group until sometime into it. So they may not have been like this, we're going to take this male-female stance that people, like that wasn't even like a characteristic of the group until
right. So emotions were affected here to choose totally something, or to form a group that was totally not
appropriate. And in a small group, a subgroup formed in an already very small group, which is unusual. You could describe that event in seemingly relatively neutral ways by saying either the seventh council person to vote said something that offended the women on the panel. Or you could say, he said something to which the women on the panel took offense. And the very slight difference between those two phrases shades, not completely, but to some degree, where the event was. Was the event in the speaking, or was the event in the offense? And again, this is something, this gets back to Andy, without being embedded in the social context, we will have a hard time looking from the outside, knowing what it's going to be. But you can bet that the answer wasn't completely, it wasn't an utterly innocent remark, completely misinterpreted. You can also bet that it wasn't specifically intended to insult a group that you were trying to come to consensus.
Right. What would be the point of that?
Exactly.
And I found it because I actually did. I did highlight it. It's the phrase was hard-hearted. Like, how is that offensive? Like, that is something that has to be interpreted as being offensive.
Right. But so the thing is, all group work is interpretive work. So in a way, we only bring up questions of interpretation when things have gotten complicated. But the problem with all groups is interpreting. You're always listening to and filtering what other people are doing. And in particular, because the audience effects that we talked about with three magic number, you're listening to what someone is saying relative to your own identity within the group, which is not, I mean, these kinds of things almost never happen in person-to-person conversation. Right? Because there's no moment at which I'm saying, I'm listening to this as a man in a group of other men who are regarding that identity as meaningful. Should I take offense at that on behalf of the group? It's the spokesperson effect we saw on day one. In fact, you standing up to talk about Conference International, you embodied, right, there was some splitting, and you embodied what that group stood for. So it may be that the group of women came to stand for femaleness in the presence of a seven-person group in a way that they probably didn't think of themselves as doing when they walked into that meeting. And it's difficult to dig yourself out of those situations when you do end up in that polarization. And often the digging out involves two individuals from the camp kind of crossing over and having conversations before you can bring the whole group together. They listed in the article three actions. They offer their own definition of groups, and it's fairly technical, so I'll bring it up just to highlight it because I think it's important. The groups they say they're in, oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
Just to continue this example, I thought what was interesting about this example is actually the seventh person, that although he was a man, he decided not to choose either, and that was an interesting point of going back and still being individual in that group and choose that position in that group.
And what did he say about not choosing either?
He didn't want to, but he put it
in an impossible situation.
Yeah,
they didn't give him any other choice.
Either side came down on because he was suddenly not helping the group come to a decision. He was actually just going to disappoint one camp or the other.
Although saying they disappointed him,
I don't understand.
It's not that he's disappointing them.
I don't understand why he didn't just flip a coin. You know, be like, all right.
Why can't you flip a coin?
Because of the emotions.
Right, but I mean, what in this situation in particular, why can't you flip a coin?
Because it's logical that you have an uneven number of people that you should just...
No. I mean, literally, we've come to a deadlock.
Yeah.
The seventh person is punted. The chair is abdicated. we've got 50-50 chance. What are the three conditions of decision-making that have to be satisfied? What is it? Well, intelligence is obviously not satisfied. But right, why not?
Because it's just random. And then before, and then like, you know, the 3-1 might support it, that would be half of them.
I mean, it's just a process of scapegoating. You're scapegoating, but you're instead of scapegoating a process or a person, you're scapegoating this like chance, this role. And it's done, you know, if the group, you know, if you can get people to agree to it.
The problem is that the group has to regard, it's a constitutional crisis, which is not, it's not just enough to have rules, you have to have rules for having the rules. The group would have to regard scapegoating, coin flipping as legitimate. If I'm sitting there across the table from a group that wants something different than me, and we're exactly deadlocked, if flipping a coin would make me support their view, And there's probably already enough commonality between the two groups that you could get a conversation going. In the case of total polarization, when one side wins and one side loses, and it's zero sum, flipping a coin would get you to a position that might do significant damage to the group as a whole by leaving bad feelings. If people weren't willing to scapegoat the coin, it would be sometimes hard to get scapegoated.
Well, you run the risk, like the person flipping the coin, a tiebreaker, runs the risk of still taking the rap, but
the mayor of that did. But I think the group plainly judged that the violence of the group from forcing a decision was worse than not making a decision in that moment. And of course, the heated emotions in rooms like that flatten out like toothpaste on paper when you write it down. So it's difficult to see, like, why didn't they just, you know, hash that and come to a decision or draw straws or whatever. But it's because two people in a row judged that since they'd suddenly been polarized so that your gender was going to be, have something to do with camp rather than joining or defecting, the violence of making a decision was too great to support. Anything else jump out to you about this, about the paradoxes of group life? Yeah.
I thought, wait, I don't know, was it this? No, wait, maybe it wasn't this. I think it was this. That forming a group was more of an intellectual process, saying that the thing about the group, I think it was in the other
region. I think that's actually from small groups and complex systems.
Yeah.
In fact, let's. I'm gonna put something up on the board from small groups and complex systems, not on a move, but an exercise in group design that puts you in charge of more of the parameters. Puts you in charge of more of the parameters than we had in the first class where I designed it, because obviously we didn't have a lot of background. So first thing I want to pull out from small groups is complex systems. And I should say about this book that for deeper reading, it's a really interesting book. They have quite a good survey of background literature. It is a little bit too theory of everything for my taste. I don't think that there is a single framework that you can look at groups through and get a perfect lens. But it does have a number of interesting models, and in particular two models that I think we'll find useful in this class. The first one is the two-axis chart. Internal forces leading the foundation of the group and external. And obviously we're now talking about, again, that moment where a group comes together to be a group and then emerge into a plan. Alright. What are the names of these quadrants?
One of them's a cop.
What's that?
One of them's a cop.
The top right.
Oh, an external plan group is they're labeling concocted, which is the boss comes to you and says, I'm going to put the five of you on this task force to go out and figure out how to raise our problem. What's founded. Down here? Founded. Plan, but internal.
Founded.
Founded. Founded. All right. What's internal but emergent?
Self-organized.
And external emergent? So, give me an example within ITP of groups that fit in these different quadrants. Yeah. What's an external planned group here?
Red class presentation groups.
Very good.
And is that like carefully plotted? I was wondering, like, in Red's class.
What do you think?
I think there is definitely planning.
There's some plotting. I mean, you don't know how careful you can be with. I mean, there's a lot of.
I'm putting the hopes in there.
Yeah.
There's a lot of subsetting you can do for four. In fact, it's probably too complex to calculate in, you know, any short amount of time, but there is human. There's certainly human guidance. It's not random.
She mentioned that.
What she meant, yeah, it's like international students at Thanksgiving or something. But I think like the first week she tries to like there's people, like there was a lot of people who were there over the summer in the first week presentation.
Yeah, I don't know what the characteristics are, but I know she works at it.
She looks at your background, where you're from, all that.
So what's an internal immersion group?
Drive-bys.
Well, there's still.
So it's interesting, isn't it? These aren't as crisp as the authors would like you to believe. So what's going on over here with this? Is this the right quadrant for TNF? No.
Well, it is. It was formed by the group, not planned by someone outside of the group, and it did emerge through social kind of happenings because there wasn't always a TNO. It came together. I think it was probably, a group of people. Decided not to talk about this.
It was. I think now.
Now it's planned.
It's got a name now, and it's happening every.
But now it's planned, right? So what it was versus what it is, or how it came to be versus.
So let me.
I'm not even sure if it's in trend.
Let me suggest. Internal merely means that the participants are also the founders. To be in this squadron, it probably means that the participants are the founders. Red does not say go drinking at the fish market. Right. So let me suggest that this is the path.
So you can say that self-organized groups would always be self-organized on whatever they are at the time that they are organized, because if the group is still existent, it's something else.
But so stuff is more than once, then it's
right.
Or
well,
if it happens regularly from something that happened once, then it.
So right, so it's solidified. And in fact, there was, somebody said earlier, it's got a name, right? There was a point at which it moved in formalization. And somebody raised a very interesting point last week that Megatron did not know, and it went about the drive-bys, which has gone through a similar thing. So I want to raise the point about the drive-bys that Megatron did not want anyone to know when or by whom it was found. Why not?
Because I think what we said in class was that she wanted to give the impression that they were always there.
Why?
People would have more respect.
Yeah, they would actually go.
But there's a legitimacy concern.
That's it?
To make it legitimate.
So, right.
And it's like Ben Franklin's tactic, right? Like he used to like when he wanted to get an idea out in the community, and he owned the printing press, which was power back then. But he found out that if he put like anonymous posters up with like I was just like this is what I think, with no statement of who it was, the community reacted. And I'm like, oh, that's a good idea. But if he said, oh, I'm Ben Franklin, and I think you should do this, everyone would turn it like start attacking.
So there's a kind of horizon that happened here that I think Megan was trying to do here, which is to make drive-by look like an external. Right? Make drive-by look like it was supported by the institution, the same way that by Franklin not putting his name on it. Right? It doesn't look like this is just one person's invention. It looks like, oh, yeah, no, this is just part of ITP. And that will probably be the case. A couple of years from now, I mean, faculty are already going around recruiting students to do drive-by.
When I first heard about it, I thought it was organized by
DP. So this shift with TNO was in particular, drive-bys are close enough that we can actually look at the moment of engineering and see that drive-bys are actually here, but that Megan was trying to get them to look back there and has largely succeeded. I mean, it'd be interesting to know from the first years whether or not drive-bys were presented to you as anything that's as a normal part of ITP life or something you find out about on your own.
Well, Jeff put like on the wiki, like put in that it was founded last summer or something, which I thought.
Jeff Gray?
Yeah. Or somebody did, but I think he made the wiki. I mean,
Jeff.
He was.
Oh, yeah. He was talking about how he got handed over to him. I already talked to him.
Yeah,
about
it was.
That should be taken out.
Right. Yeah, I was a little surprised.
I had to talk to Jeff.
But it was after I already had a relationship to what drive-bys were, and after I'd already formulated for myself that they had been around for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't really, it's just like, oh, well, that's weird, you know?
Right. No, they're quite reasonable. I mean, they were founded and Megan wanted them to look as if they were not.
Megan and Christina.
Megan and Christina. Anything up here?
So the shows kind of feel good like that. The dynamics of the show.
Well, good. Go on.
Well, it's external because it's organized by faculty. And somehow there are, you know, dynamics that occur in terms of how things work. Each one finds their space and what they need. And then as the event occurs, people kind of have an understanding of what's going on. And when cleanup time comes, everything happens.
Or any elevator ride.
Except, does elevator ride, I think, is going to fall down to the weak group part of our threshold. We say there's not a lot of either shared effort or shared effort. But there is something going on in the, well, I can't call it the main lab anymore, it's called the video lab, which tends to be where the most environmentally complex pieces go. So suddenly you're in a room with a bunch of people and you have to decide where to hang the drapes and how to do the lighting, and that room, compared to any place else in the show, seems to require group effort among all the individual participants to get the room right. Sound levels, light levels, and so forth.
I think the firmware lab is probably a good example.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because there's a lot of communication, like people helping each other out when you're in there. And you're like,
right. Yeah, there was a move foot, a conversation foot about decommissioning the firmware lab if we move to wiring, if we move to open source firmware software. But it seems to me the social capital produced by the room is actually more important than the fact that we've got a laptop with commercial software on. So you can see, pressing this into service, right, that you can start to put groups on this axis. You can also see that the cleanliness of the two-axis chart, beloved by consultants everywhere, fails the real-world test of being a completely obvious, of leaving completely obvious quadrants for putting things. And you can see things like the passage of time or the design of the founder can create effects where something either moves one quadrant or another, or is part of one quadrant but seems to be part of that. Nevertheless, I think this group this grouping of things makes a certain amount of sense. So here's the exercise I want to do. Is 17 in here now or 16? Let's go down the table by four. So for Carol and A, you go 1, 2, 3, 4. You guys can count. And then 1, 2, 3, 4. Perfect. So 4, 2, and 4. It's Jackie, you're there, and then it's Motor Center. And then Hunter, take the
four.
Yeah, four. So four groups of four. So here's the exercise. Imagine an ITP has been given $10 million, not as a gift, but as a bit of working capital. And the idea is that ITP's goals in the world are goals for things like the girls' school on the Lower East Side, for things like assistive technology, et cetera, are to be supported by the roughly $1 million a year in interest that $10 million throws off. Your job right now in your group of four is to come up with as many ways as possible for ITP to decide how to allocate $1 million a year to not-for-profit causes. I want you to do it as a group. I want you to write one idea on each hex. I want you to write it big. I'm going to give you a whiteboard marker.
Are you advocating we invest in junk bonds?
No. So here are the strictures. It has to be a goal related to ITP. Right. You do not have to. We're uninterested in the causes. That was the exercise we won. We are uninterested in the causes. We are now interested in the process by which the institution decides how to allocate the money. So it has to be not-for-profit and a goal that is related to ITP's other work. So for instance, Heifers International would fall out, but something that was about, say, moving solar energy into countries that are off the grid would potentially be in. Something that's about assistive technology would be definitely in. You don't have to pick. You have to decide how the group would decide.
Second, it has to be broadly supported by ITP as a whole. And third, there has to be some accountability, which is to say, once a money is dispersed, there has to be some way of watching where it goes.
We're writing down the institution, we're writing down the process.
You're writing down the process. Okay. In particular, you're writing down all the ways you can think of that ITP as an entity could decide how to spend the money. And don't go crazy. Don't say, flip a coin, roll a dice. Right? Both of those are roughly the same process. I'm looking for large ideas. They could involve the whole group. They could involve some subset of the group. But what are all the ways in which this institution could come to an annual decision in a way that allowed us to allocate money to an external cause and had some notion of kind of keeping an eye on it after the fact? It's not just getting rid of the money, but the beginning of the relationship. So don't spend a lot of time cogitating. This is really about just getting out as many
hands. So this is
I will put these up and organize them. So let's take a break, and we'll take a look at what we've got when we get back.